Well, Ty, you made an accurate guess. We are indeed in Daniel chapter 6, so I invite you to open your Old Testaments to that spot. Daniel chapter 6. For some of us, the greatest tests that we face in our lives might come at the beginning of our lives, like it seemed to happen for Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego back there in chapter 3. They faced the choice to bow to an idol that Nebuchadnezzar had made or die. And they made the right choice. But for others of us and others in biblical history, sometimes the greatest test that we face in our lives might come at the end, as it seemed to happen for Daniel in chapter 6. When we pick up his story, he is a very, very old man. And so even though he seemed to somehow escape the chapter 3 situation, he is now faced with a choice to either pray to a man, to the king that he serves, or die, as he is an 80-something-year-old man, probably. You know, you and I just never know when our faithfulness to God is going to be tested or not. But we do know that we are living in a culture that, even though it preaches tolerance, tolerance, tolerance for all religions, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, that's the America that's in our founding documents and that people pay lip service to. We do know that in our culture, everybody is becoming in the world increasingly intolerant, especially of the Bible and biblical teachings and Christians who follow Jesus Christ. And we also know that regardless of whatever culture we are living in, whether it's America or somewhere else, all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. And that's scripture. That's 2 Timothy 3:12. And so in Daniel's time, living in Persia, he believed that his God was worthy of absolute, complete trust, and that outweighed the horrors of being thrown into a pit of apex predators, as he ends up having to undergo here. And so in large or small ways, all of us are going to be tempted at some point, in large or small ways, to conform to the images of our culture, the values of our world that we live in, rather than the ways of our God. And we will be faced with this choice that Daniel was faced with. Will we put our trust completely in the one who is worthy of it? So let's go to Daniel 6, and let's start reading this text together, verses 1 through 9. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three high officials, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account, so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Then the high officials and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God." Then these high officials and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, "O King Darius, live forever. All the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked." Therefore, King Darius signed the document and the injunction. So we are now shifting gears in Daniel's life. For most of his days, he has been in exile living in Babylon under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar and the kings of Babylon that came after him. And now the empire has gone down the drain. A new empire has arisen, just as Nebuchadnezzar's own dream foretold that there's the head of gold in this statue of the different nations, but there are other metals, there are other nations that come after that head. And so now we're on the next set of body parts of that statue. We're in the Persian time period. But what's really neat to see about this is that Daniel's excellent spirit, as it says here in chapter 6, is just as appreciated by his new bosses as it was during the days of the old empire. If you go back to chapter 5 in verse 12, just as Babylon is about to bite the dust, do you remember how when the queen mother comes in after the writing's on the wall and everybody's freaking out in the banquet room, and the queen mother comes in and says, well, I know a guy, and you really ought to know him too. In chapter 5, verse 12, the same phrase is used here: in excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret, explain riddles, solve problems were found in this Daniel. And so everybody understands this about him. And so, by this point in his life, Daniel has worn a lot of hats. Remember, when he was first taken captive, he is recruited to become a wise man for the Babylonians. And then he is quickly discovered to be extra special because the spirit of the gods is in him. And so he is elevated to the position of ruler over the province of Babylon and the chief job of magician over all the other wise men. And in chapter 5, remember, for just a few hours, big whoop, he gets to be the third ruler in the kingdom of Babylon before Babylon just keels over and dies. But then when the Persians come, they recognize his talents and his abilities, and he becomes one of the top three officials at the apex of the pyramid of government. And the king, as we're told here in chapter 6, is planning to set him over the entire kingdom. Doesn't that remind us a lot about another Israelite man in the book of Genesis who was a captive, who was in exile? Remember what happened to Joseph? He is set over all of the Egyptians second after the Pharaoh, after he interprets the dreams of the king. I'm reminded of a proverb when I read Daniel's story. Proverbs 22:29. Do you see a man skillful in his work? He will stand before kings, as Daniel does throughout his life. He will not stand before obscure men. Obviously, all of our skills, all of our opportunities to show our whatever skills that we have, all of those things have been given, have been handed over to us by God. They're not things that we just create for ourselves. But notice how Daniel uses what he is given. He's not just intelligent and educated. He's not just handsome and good looking and smart. He is all those things, but he is fair and he is just in his dealings with everybody else. He is attentive to the oppressed and the poor. Because remember, when he advises Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, oh, you know, I really don't want this dream to happen to you. Here's some advice. Pay attention to the people that you've been stepping on, the people that need your help. You're the king. You can have power to use for those people. Daniel, I get the sense, has used his power for other people as well. He's a beacon of righteousness in an ungodly world, and God has chosen to elevate Daniel so that God can elevate his own name and show how holy and magnificent he is. So that's Daniel's position as chapter 6 opens up. But Daniel very quickly runs into some roadblocks in the form of jealous officials. So I want you to notice that Darius is not the only person who is making plans about Daniel. If Daniel is not going to be an official who takes bribes like so many officials do and have done for thousands of years, if he's not going to play ball with the rest of the team, then he's got to go, especially if he's a Jew, especially if he's one of those nasty exiles who thinks he's so much better than everybody else. And so here we're told that not only are the other two high officials plotting against Daniel, but the satraps, at least some of these 120 other guys, are in on the same plot against Daniel. In chapter 7, when the bait is laid and in front of the king, the plotters tell the king that everybody agrees. Everybody who's anybody, governors, whoever it is, agrees that we ought to make this law for you, O king. I guess everybody except Daniel. And the plot they come up with is really, I think, pretty clever. They can't find anything to pin on Daniel in terms of the way that he does his job. And isn't that an extremely remarkable thing to say about somebody? That when they looked at how Daniel managed the books, when they looked at everything Daniel did and the relationships that he had and everything that had to do with his job, and I'm sure it encompassed a whole lot since he's one of the top guys in the whole government, they couldn't find anything to say, oh, this is a really big problem. Could people say that about you? In your job, could they say that about me? This is an extremely wonderful example here in terms of how to behave in the world. And so they say, well, we've got to create this religious trap. And this plan that they come up with, I think it appeals to the insecurities and the vanity of a king who is probably at this point still trying to lock down his position. I mean, he's a brand new king in terms of the way that the Persians have come into power. And so the thought of everybody turning their attention to him and praying to him, that sounds like a pretty good thing to do in his shoes. So let's treat you, Darius, like a god for a whole month. Nobody can pray to anything else, anybody else, any other god, any other king. And so in verse 9, it's kind of interesting to me that he doesn't even give a verbal response. Like, he doesn't offer any pushback. He doesn't ask any questions. What's behind this for you guys? You know, he might have probed this just a little bit more than he did. But in verse 9, without seemingly saying anything, he takes his pen and he adds his signature, and that is done. Doesn't this remind us of Psalm 2? Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart. Let us cast away their cords from us. But what's God's response in that psalm? He who sits in heaven laughs. The Lord holds them in derision because they had the audacity to think that they can actually stand in his way. He is the King of Kings, and he's going to show that now another time in the book of Daniel, and he's going to judge these enemies who plot together against his appointed man. Well, let's pick up the text here in verse 10 and see what happens. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house, where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. Then they came and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, yep, thing stands fast, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. When the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed." Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. Things take a turn for the worse, as tends to happen in this book concerning the people of God. But as we know from reading the text, deliverance is around the corner. But for Daniel, he doesn't know that. But what he does do is he maintains his expressions of faith that he has made a habit of doing, even though he knows that this very well might be the end of his life. He knows the law, he knows the consequences of breaking it, but he goes home and he does what he has always done before. Notice what he does. Long before Muslims started praying toward the city of Mecca, the Jewish people, especially after they were scattered from their homeland, had prayed toward the city of Jerusalem. I was on a plane going to Israel one time in 2019, and I would notice Orthodox Jews getting up in their seats and putting on their prayer garb and praying toward Jerusalem, toward the front of the plane. So Jews do this to this day, and Daniel does this in ancient days. Even though the temple and Jerusalem itself was just about totally destroyed at this particular stage of history, there's not much of Jerusalem left. Solomon's, the beautiful edifice that he created for the glory of God, that's gone. But he still prays toward his homeland with windows open because he wants to fulfill 1 Kings 8. Do you remember when Solomon built the temple and he dedicates the temple and he prays to God? Do you remember what he says in 1 Kings 8? "Listen to the plea of your people Israel when they pray toward this place, and when you hear in heaven, forgive." And so we're given a glimpse into Daniel and how faithful he is to God and what his habits look like in his faithfulness. Did you notice how many times a day he prays? We're given the frequency of his prayer life, and I don't think this is just talking about breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And he prays three times with special emphasis on the thanksgiving and the pleas and the petitions that he wants to direct to God outside of his thankfulness for his meals. Do we do that? We're also told about his posture. Keep in mind, this man is most likely in his 80s, and yet how is he praying? He's getting down on his knees. I don't imagine for an extremely old man that that is something that is comfortable for him to do, but he does it anyway. And by the way, Daniel's only one of three characters in the Old Testament that actually took a posture in prayer like this. Solomon and Ezra are the only other two that we have a record of doing that. And then in the content of his prayer, in verse 10, now verse 10 mentions thanksgiving, and then the next verse after that mentions the pleas and the petitions. I just think it's so interesting, though, that Daniel, by this time in his life, even though he's been in exile for the vast majority of his life, and as far as I know, he is never going to have the chance to get back home, he's not a bitter old man. He's still thankful. He's a thankful servant, despite his continued time in now Persia. I get the sense from talking to older Christians in all different kinds of places and settings and situations that as life goes on, as you see more and more things that disappoint you, you go through more and more experiences that are hard, time under the sun just gets harder as you get into your 70s and your 80s. It becomes harder and harder to become thankful. And so it is such a wonderful example that Daniel stands as a beacon to us about what old age can be like if we're doing it in the eyes of God in the way that we should. He is thankful, and he is focusing more on God than he is on himself. I have to ask myself, I think you have to ask yourself, when we come to a passage like this, do we have these kinds of habits built into our daily lives so that in times of difficulty, we already know what we're going to do, because in times of ease, we have already developed or allowed God to develop our characters in the way that they should be. You know, there's nothing wrong with spontaneous prayer in little moments of our days, as we're mowing the lawn, as we're washing some dishes, as we're going somewhere in our cars. Those moments have been special and needful for me in my prayer life with God. But there is and should be a place for structured, regular time that we spend with God on a regular basis. And Scripture encourages us in stories like this one to deliberately put prayer into our days. Not to just let it be this thing that we happen upon once in a while when it's convenient for us. And this is convicting for me, because I am not always as diligent about this as I should be. Far too easily, I allow the busyness of my day to consume my mental time, and I don't give that thought to God. And if I'm being really honest with myself, sometimes it seems like prayer is one of the least productive things that I could be doing with my time. But in reality, prayer is perhaps one of the most productive things that we could be doing with our time. And if you look at guys like Daniel, like Job, who routinely got up at the crack of dawn to pray for his kids, if you think about Paul, who saturates his letters with, I'm praying for you, I'm praying for you, I'm praying for your church, and this person, and this person. If you look at Jesus Christ himself, who routinely got away from the crowds and his own apostles to go to his Father, if you look at all these godly people in history, you see that prayer is not just something that is an afterthought. Prayer is an integral part of their daily existence. That's challenging for me. Is it challenging for you? Daniel maintains these habits, but maybe in my case or your case, we need to develop these habits so that we can maintain them when the time comes that we are tested. I think it's interesting when we look at what happens to Daniel, when we look at what happens after we're told about his prayers. He is arrested. He is put into the lion's den. In our culture, we speak of an ordeal as just a painful experience that sometimes we go through. But in these times, in ancient days, an ordeal was a literal event that some people who were accused of a crime went through. Sometimes, instead of a judge pronouncing a judgment, the judge would just say, we're going to throw you into that river over there, and if you can swim to safety, then you must be innocent, but if you drown, then you're probably guilty. We're just going to leave your case up to the gods to decide. That seems to be what's going on with Daniel when he is brought in, this accusation is made, and he's thrown into the den of lions. Look at what Darius says. Boy, I hope that your God can deliver you, but we're leaving this all in the hands of the divine ones to save you or not, because this duped king is powerless to rescue from his own law, which proves that our hope is not in princes. I think we've mentioned Psalm 146 before in the course of these sermons, but it's so important, I'm going to mention it again. Do you remember how Psalm 146 says, "Put not your trust in princes, in a son of man in whom there is no salvation"? I think this story is one of those perfect examples of how that works. A ruler, a king, is supposed to be wise, but rulers make mistakes. Sometimes they can be corrupted, they have errors of judgment, and even if they want to do the right thing in some cases, like Darius tries to do after he recognizes that the wool's been pulled over his own eyes, he's got his hands tied behind his back. I don't entirely understand why the laws of the Medes and the Persians can't be retracted, but for whatever reason, that was really big in their culture. And so even though Nebuchadnezzar tries to throw his guys into a furnace in rage after he discovers that they're not serving his God, when Darius finds out that Daniel's not been praying to him, he tries to rescue him. He tries to help him any way that he can. But by the time the day's over, he has no solutions, and he has to tacitly admit his own weaknesses by telling Daniel that he hopes that his God's able to do what he himself can't do. So let's look at the deliverance that happens for Daniel. Verse 19, "Then at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, 'Oh, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?' And Daniel said to the king, 'O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him. And also before you, O king, I've done no harm.' Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. And Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, 'Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed. His dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions.' So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian." Remember back in chapter 5, Belshazzar is weighed in the balances and he is found wanting. And so he dies that very night. Well, but now in this chapter, we've got a man whose name means God is my judge. He is weighed out, and he is found blameless. He is found faithful. And so just as a fourth person shows up inside of the burning furnace to demonstrate, hey, God's rescuing these people, so it is that a second person shows up in the den of lions. The angel comes and saves him from the lions. I think it's interesting that the plotters, the people arrayed against Daniel, wanted to make sure that nothing changes according to what they have set against him. And so, nothing changes. You know, Daniel goes in as a man who is praying and worshiping his God. And guess what? He comes out of the den as a man with no harm on him who is worshiping and serving his God. Because he trusted. When we think about the fate of the officials here, I think about another proverb, Proverbs 26:27. Whoever digs a pit will fall into it. But and a stone will come back on him who starts it rolling. The people who are plotting actually get thrown into the exact same pit that they prepared for Daniel, except unlike him, they're not coming out of it alive. And their families also suffered for their foolishness. But when we look at Daniel 6 and we look at what happens here, I think we can clearly see this arc that points toward another biblical character who had some of these same things happen to him. Think about what's going on here. A righteous man who has an excellent spirit is surrounded by a bunch of jealous enemies. Does this sound familiar? And these jealous enemies skillfully manipulate the ruler in charge of the situation to condemn this righteous man to death. Does that sound familiar? And this blameless man is taken and sealed into a place of death. And a stone is rolled over the entrance of that place. But against all odds, the blameless, righteous man escapes and comes out alive from his tomb and meets his supporter at the break of day because God has rescued him. See, we've heard all of those things before because that's the story of Jesus Christ and his death and burial and resurrection from his grave. And this shows us that stories like Daniel 6 are not just entertaining accounts for tiny tots in a Bible class. These are powerful stories that pierce the hearts of adults, too, that show the long-term faithfulness and planning and foresight of our God. Even as God oversees Babylon and Persia and the people in them and his own people in this generation, so it is that he is already at this point planning for how Jesus is going to defeat death. So Daniel was found blameless before the king, but more importantly, before his God. And then for the third time in this book, a foreign king is praising God for his everlasting kingdom. What Darius says there at the end of chapter 6 is very similar to what Nebuchadnezzar has already said at the beginning and end of chapter 4 as he writes his letter to the nations that he ruled over. And what I think is neat about Darius is that even though he made a really dumb decision here because he's an idolater and he's just thinking about himself, he didn't have to get turned into an animal like Nebuchadnezzar did in order to come to the conclusion that Nebuchadnezzar eventually comes to that, oh, this God is not like any other God. Yet another king finds out that the sins and the weaknesses of the Jewish people, which got them into exile to begin with, that's very different from the God that rules over them. And this God's jurisdiction is not just limited to Palestine. You know, it's not, it's just, he's the God of over there. No, he's the God of everywhere. He's the God whose hand can reach into a palace in Babylon and write on the plaster wall. He's a God who can reach into a Persian den of lions and rescue his 80-plus-year-old servant from their mouths. He saves, he destroys. His will trumps all other wills. Any desires of any human leader, he does whatever he pleases, and he is a God to be feared above all gods. That is why Daniel was saved and rescued, because he believed that, and God saved him in order to show other people that they should be believing that too. Daniel thought of God as worthy of all his trust. Is that deeply within our hearts as well? We have to ask that question. I want to go to the scripture that Joel read to us before the lesson and read a few verses from that larger section that he read. The Hebrew writer is wrapping up his wonderful account of people who lived in faith. And he says, "What more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, and Samuel, and the prophets, of whom Daniel was one, who through faith, through belief, through trust, conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises," and here it is, "stopped the mouths of lions, and quenched the power of fire." Daniel and his three friends are not mentioned by name in this account, but I think it's pretty clear from those two phrases that Daniel 3 and Daniel 6 are very much in the minds of the writer of that New Testament book when he wrote these things down. So these stories are here to teach us about a God who is worthy of our trust because these people put their trust in this God and they were not disappointed by that. They were saved. More importantly, they weren't just saved from big cats and big superheated furnaces. They were saved from the clutches of the evil one because our Lord, who is Daniel foreshadows, went to the cross, came out of his tomb alive, and has now sat down at the right hand of the throne on high, and he's forgiven all the sins of anybody who puts their trust in him. That is the God that we honor today. And so Daniel and his friends, they didn't know about Jesus Christ. They and all of the prophets that are being talked about here and all these characters in Bible history, they had small little glimpses into the time that we now live in where the whole plan is laid out in front of us. But they did cling to God in the belief that he would make it all work out in the end. And he has. He has. And so Daniel and his friends are waiting for us to join them. Did you remember what is said back at in Hebrews 11 at the very end of what Joel read for us? Hebrews 11, 39. "And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God has promised something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect." Daniel and his friends, and everyone else who has been faithful to God throughout the ages, is waiting for the final day when all of God's people will join them at his throne. And so that's what we're doing here today, is we are honoring this God who is moving all of human history toward that moment in time. Are you ready for that day? Are you honoring God and trusting him in your life now so that you can be made perfect later? Let's think about this question as we stand up and we sing the invitation song together.